Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps,
Scott Tobias,
and
Genevieve Kosky,
coming back in front of the mic from her usual producer position. This week, we're talking about Joel and Ethan Coen's movies Barton Fink and Hail Caesar, two films released 25 years apart, but both about the hapless wrecks of humanity working for the fictional Capitol Pictures at the height of the studio system. They're very different movies. Barton Fink is about a struggling screenwriter, played by John Turturro, alone in a ratty hotel trying to bang out the script to a Wallace Beery wrestling pitcher he has no connection to. Hail Caesar is inspired by real-life studio fixer Eddie Mannix, who handled scandals for MGM, and it stars Josh Brolin as a character named Eddie Mannix, who's trying to manage Capitol Pictures' constant crises and stable of unruly stars while pondering over an opportunity to walk away and take a lucrative job at Lockheed Aviation. But both films are fundamentally about the trouble of making art, whether that trouble comes from external sources or internal ones, and both of them are write-what-you-know stories about the industry the Coens have lived in for decades. On this half of the podcast, we're going to dig into what connects the two films, look at the Coens' long-running stable of actors, and ask ourselves whether they've changed, their attitudes on Hollywood have changed, or these are just very different movies coming from the same warped sensibilities.
Oh, Monty. Come, join me on the divan. It seems Allegra's a no-show, which is simply a bore. But I'll partner you in bridge.
Ha! Would that it were so simple.
Cut. 27 apples, take two.
All right, let's try this. Your line, just say it as I say it. Say your line exactly as I'm about to.
Okay, sure.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were...
Watch my mouth. Would that it were so simple, trippingly.
Would that it were so simple, trippingly.
No, don't say trippingly. Say the line trippingly.
Gosh, I can't seem to cinch my saddle up on this. Larry.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so...
Hang down.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple.
Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple. Would that it were so simple.
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 It's complicated.
So let's start with connections. How did you guys feel watching Hail Caesar in terms of like how it connects or doesn't connect to Barton Fink?
My first thought after watching Hail Caesar is a, you know, in some ways it's a rebuke and an apology for Barton Fink, you know, which I don't think I think there implies a level of sincerity that the Coens aren't necessarily capable of, especially in Barton Fink or Hail Caesar. But if we encountered in our journey through the many genres of Golden Age Hollywood, the Hail Caesar visits, if we ran into a Wallace Beery wrestling picture, we kind of get a sense of why a Wallace Beery wrestling picture, though it involves a lot of conflicting personalities and behind the scenes machinations, but there's a bit of magic to it. I think there's a little bit of magic to all of the pastiches and homages of classic Hollywood we encounter here. Like the Channing Tatum musical sequence is wonderful. The Esther Williams homage that Scarlett Johansson performs, just beautiful to look at, and it has that really nice touch which you'll sometimes see in old movies where you can see her panting behind her smile as she does it. You can see the effort that goes into this performance too. It's a little, sometimes the films themselves give you a little peek behind the curtain, and this to me was a deeper peek behind the curtain. But the Hollywood that Barton Fink encounters, at least, is a corrupting cesspool. Even though it's in a desert, there's still mosquitoes there. But this is a different sort of Hollywood. It has its own issues, but ultimately, I forget who, maybe it's Amy Nicholson or somebody, described it as a love letter written with a poison pen, and there's a little bit of that too. It's sort of a loving look at something that is perhaps phony and troubled, but also kind of wonderful in its own way.
And one of the lines I wrote down in my notebook when I saw Hail Caesar was, I think it was the narrator that briefly appears referred to a film as another piece of gossamer, which I think is, aside from being just a lovely image, is a really interesting way to talk about the creation of film in the context that they're doing here, and to an extent Barton Fink, like where it's almost disposable. And I think it's very interesting that they are dealing with films that are disposable and actors and writers who are interchangeable, and kind of wrestling with what it means to make a statement within that system. I think it's specifically interesting that they came back to this specific era both times in the studio system, and how that butts up against the artistic sensibility, or not in the case of Hail Caesar.
One connection is their continued contempt for writers with a certain leftist ideology. I mean, I don't think there's, you know, this is not the most flattering portrait of communist writers.
There's that one scene where they're bragging to Baird Whitlock, George Clooney's character, about all the leftist messages they snuck into films, and it's maybe he's a dimmer bulb than most, but it's clearly that no one's noticed any of these messages that are supposed to be changing things.
And speaking of Barton Fink connections, like during that scene, they keep talking about the little guy and how, you know, communism is sticking up for the little guy. And they see themselves as the little guy within the studio system. And every time they said little guy, it's like, oh, that's the common man. You know, it's like the same thing. But it's I definitely saw some echoes in the writers who made up the future and Barton Fink's lofty ideals.
You should probably spell out that the organization is called The Future, because the yes. writers that make up The Future sounds like a, right. I don't know, just a very interesting concept.
They're kind of the Barton Finks who fit in, the kind of the Barton Finks who worked.
They're the Barton Finks who are comfortable. Like, there's sort of a sense, there's a little bit of anger in the room in the form of, like, the one guy who keeps shouting, but for the most part, they seem a little like...
played by Dave Krumholtz. I was great
oh
at that.
God. Oh, yeah, so for good. Sure. There's so many really great actors in that scene, and they don't have character names. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't stand it out at all. Half of them are credited as, you know, communist writer number three or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, what Krumholtz just has the mustache, and he shouts parasite once in a while. The other thing, too, about the writers, another point in terms of how they fit in, is just writers are the single most aggrieved people in the entire studio system, and so the film really captures
in the world.
Right. I mean, they just are so powerless. Their work is trampled upon. They get no respect. They get no money. And I think it feels like it's less kind of this communist gathering than just kind of a grousing session.
Do they get no money? Like, because the whole thing in Barton Fink is that it's an easy way to make a quick buck for a couple
sure,
of years,
maybe,
and that's why Mayhew
credit.
Stuck around
maybe it's
for so long,
that,
you know?
Maybe it's credit that they don't.
Like, I kind of got the sense that they had nurtured a sense of entitlement over the years that allowed them to develop these highfalutin ideas based in grievances that they may not actually have.
But I mean, one of the things that draws the sharpest contrast between Barton Fink and Hail Caesar is that there's kind of a sense of, like, maybe they're meaningfully aggrieved and maybe they're not, but either way, it doesn't matter, because this is such a, like, a no harm, no foul universe. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody gets kidnapped and held for ransom, and he has a fine time talking with his kidnappers. Like, there's no malevolence there. There are all of these Hollywood scandals that are going on, but none of them are about, you know, somebody that raped a girl to death with a bottle in his hotel room. They're all just kind of, you know, she got knocked up and she kind of doesn't want to marry the dude because he's a jerk. Or, you know, oh, we're going to put these two together and make sure that their dating is seen by the local head hopper version. Like, there's no anger, like, to the movie. There's even the whole ridiculous communist plot just kind of amounts to, like, a Fargo-esque lost briefcase full of money. Like, there's no gain to it. There's no benefit to anything that happens. You kind of end up in a very burn-after-reading place, as so many of the comedy movies that the Coens make do end up, where kind of you're back to square one and not a whole lot has been learned, except maybe by Eddie Mannix, who's learned that he loves the pictures, he loves the industry, and he wants to stay with it.
What's interesting, the amount of sympathy, I guess, it shows toward Mannix. I mean, you could paint a portrait of someone like Eddie Mannix, that it's quite dark.
As a real Eddie Mannix apparently was.
Right. And this is, and I could see, I guess, people having their ruffled feathers about this. You talk about money. I mean, there may be a certain amount of money, but studios controlled everything. They controlled where, who could be in movies and who, you know, where everybody was on the lot. And it's not like anyone had the kind of leverage that they have today to really negotiate, you know, better deals for themselves or put themselves in better positions. It's a lot tougher. But the film doesn't really care about that. The film really respects the idea of the studio, of the old studio system as a system that worked as this incredible machine that this guy was kind of keeping together, because Hollywood is full of flakes that have to be sort of brought in line.
Yeah, and the
communists
protected.
Are just another group of people who are out of line. And when you know, Baird Whitlock gets sort of roped into that world, he's got to get it literally slapped out of him.
I mean, we may tell ourselves that we're creating something of artistic value, or there's some sort of spiritual dimension to the picture business, but what it really is this fat cat, Nick Skank, out in New York, running this factory, serving up these lollipops to the, what they used to call the bread and circuses for Now you listen to me, Buster. Nick Skank and the studio have been good to you and to everyone else who works here. If I ever hear you bad-mouthing Mr. Skank again, it'll be the last thing you say before I have you tossed in jail for colluding in your own abduction.
Eddie, I would never do that.
Shut up. You're going to go out there and you're going to finish Hail Caesar. You're going to give that speech to the feet of the penitent thief and you're going to believe every word you say. You're going to do it because you're an actor and that's what you do. Just like the director does what he does and the writer and the script girl and the guy who claps the slate. You're going to do it because the picture has worth, and you have worth if you serve the picture, and you're never going to forget that again.
It's notable, I think, that Eddie has to choose between working for Hollywood and working for Lockheed. The attitude seems to be you have to serve somebody and you may as well be in this rather silly universe that makes wonderful, frivolous motion pictures than, you know, serving an industry that, all, you know, one of its goals is, you know, bettering the ways to deliver death from above. It's a topic, is a whole other topic unto itself. But, you know, obviously there's not the most reverent take on Christianity. But I also think ultimately it is kind of respectful of Eddie's faith. You know, he is a grown up and a moral person in a world of immoral children. And there's something kind of noble about the way he goes about his business in a way.
Well, he's relatively moral, you know, like
trying to be a moral person.
As you know, as I have so often said with the Coens, it's not about a larger morality. It's about, does he follow his code? Mm-hmm. And he is very, very penitent about even the smallest breaks in his code. Like, he's what passes for a moral man in their universe because he has his beliefs and he follows them, and he's ashamed when he doesn't and tries
when he
to
goes
make
more
up
than literally when he goes more than 24 hours without going to confession. Like,
yeah,
I love that detail of, like, he has the hours since his last confession, like, down to the minute.
My son, it's really too often. Yeah. But Keith was talking about the conundrum of staying and working for Hollywood versus leaving Hollywood, which fits really nicely into the first of our topics. Scott?
That would be Hollywood.
Hollywood?
The Coens' relationship to Hollywood throughout their career has been strange because they haven't made that many straight up studio films, but they also haven't, after a certain point, made small budget independent movies either, at least the way we think of small budget indies to be. They've involved themselves quite a bit with labels that have come and gone, like USA Films or Gramercy Pictures, places like that. They've had their work distributed by boutique labels with studio associations, but they've never quite fit in. I remember when they put in that line from Hudsucker Proxy, you know, for kids. that was their jokey attempt to satisfy, you know, their big Hollywood producer, who is Joel Silver, you know, who did, what, Die Hard, right? And all sorts of other movies that had nothing Hollywood catchphrases in them. But the Coens obviously have a deep affection for the old Hollywood that comes out in Hail Caesar. You know, we could have done this episode and included one of many movies referenced in Hail Caesar, from you know, Esther Williams' Aqua musicals to Ben-Hur, and they owe plenty themselves to movies like Sullivan's Travels and The Glass Key and other classics. And one of the things I love about Hail Caesar is that it's so much cheerier about that world than Barton Fink, which turns Capitol Pictures into a B-movie production facility with a blowhard studio head and a system that grinds up every writer who comes to the door. Hail Caesar admires, I think, at the very least, the way that a powerful studio could assert house style and keep their talent in order. And they especially admire individuals, you know, who have that ability to keep the machine running.
Well, yeah, and we touched on this briefly in the first part, but the Coens have kept, like, their very specialized, specific machine going. Like, they are, I wouldn't necessarily call them prolific, but they are steady filmmakers. Like, you know, you don't, Miller's crossing writer's block aside, like, you don't get the sense that they are necessarily struggling to put films out.
But also they understand that there's the mechanics to it, and there's a process that has to be done.
Well, and that's something that comes through in their style, which we'll get into too. But they, you know, they do seem very invested and fascinated with the mechanics of filmmaking. I mean, there's a great scene in Hail Caesar in the editing bay with Frances McDormand, and you know, just kind of, she is the, like, the quintessential just like wonk, you know, doing the dirty work, kind of literally, of putting a film together, and almost dies doing it, but then just continues on because that's what she does. You
I mean,
know?
She's kind of, she's surrounded by these, like, clacking machines, and she's kind of half machine herself. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, for me, like, one of the things that struck me most, I guess, about the difference between this film and Barton Fink, just like sheerly in terms of Hollywood and how they deal with Hollywood, Roger Ebert's review of Barton Fink made the kind of the interesting point that all three of their pre-Barton Fink films featured, like, the image of, like, a big man behind a desk, like, bellowing orders. In Blood Simple, I'm just going to read this. In Blood Simple, the guy behind the desk was Emmett Walsh as a scheming private detective. In Raising Arizona, it was Trey Wilson's furniture czar. In Miller's Crossing, it was Albert Finney as a mob boss. In Barton Fink, it's Michael Lerner as the head of the Hollywood studio. All of these men are vulgar, smoke cigars, and view their supplicants with contempt. But when we, by the time you get to Hail Caesar, the man behind the desk chomping on a cigar and, like, dispensing barking orders, I mean, he's Josh Brolin. He's kind of the hero of the piece. He's the guy who gets things done. And he is, as you say, like, literally slapping his stars around to get them in line. He's, you know, ordering Ray Fiennes to, you know, go deal with the ridiculous thing that the studio is making him do, which does not at all work with the art that he's trying to make. So there is a certain dismissiveness still to the man behind the desk barking orders, but at the same time, that man is visualized as a very moral guy who at least thinks he's trying to do the best that he can.
Let me make 2 points about that, actually, because I don't think I don't really feel like Mannix fits that man behind the desk thing, which is in a lot of Coen Brothers films, because he's out in the field all the time. I mean, he doesn't stay at his desk. I mean, the first time we see him, he's out, you know, rescuing one of his stars from, you know, a photography session. So he's kind of out there. And I think that the man behind the desk is coming through on his phone and ordering him to do things that make no sense, like put somebody who's a Western star in a costume drama. The way I kind of think about Hail Caesar is, like, it's Barton Fink if Ben Geisler was the hero. You know, Ben Geisler is not a precise analog for Eddie Mannix, but I think that's the type, because he's not the head of the studio. I mean, Eddie Mannix is the head of the studio, Ben Geisler is the head of the studio, but they get movies made.
But I mean, he's still sitting behind his desk when he gives Ray Fiennes his marching orders. When he gives,
he got those marching orders from someone else.
But he doesn't seem to have a damn bit of sympathy for the director trying to deal with this, like, completely irrational
but
thing.
But I see Eddie Mannix. I think when you get down to it, he's a very large cog in the machine, but he's still a cog in the machine. Like, I don't think he is the capricious studio head, you know, making these decisions. He's the one carrying out those decisions.
Are you suggesting, Tasha, that their sympathies have shifted from the little man to the big guys over the course
of the guys getting it done?
Yeah.
Not entirely, but I do think that just as Hail Caesar has a lot more love for what comes out of the process that we see, like, Barton Fink failing at, basically, I think that it has a lot more enthusiasm for machinery pictures, you know, for the pictures that come out of specifically this kind of process. I don't know. There's such a dismissiveness in Barton Fink towards, you know, Wallace Beery, wrestling pitcher. Do I have to draw you a roadmap? Like, it's obvious. big, broad, you know, there's a guy, there's going to be some fighting, and then there's going to be a girl or an orphan or both, whatever. There's a sense throughout Barton Fink that you're meant to be very dismissive of this idea of the formula. But the films that we see, like in front of the screen in Hail Caesar, are very formulaic. You know, you've got the very programmatic visual, like Esther Williams swimming musical. You've got the sing and dance, you know, Anchors Away take off with the singing sailors doing their weird pastiche that's sort of out of South Pacific and that's very, very gay. Like all of these things are...
Don't forget Lonely Old Moon.
Or you might call it a little fruity.
It is a little fruity, which is why Wallace Beery is not in there in a sailor's cap. Or the Western with its trick riding and roping and whatnot. Yeah. These are all very programmatic things, but the film like gives them such affection. Like if we did see a Wallace Beery film in this thing, it would be probably seen with a great deal of love.
Perhaps. I mean, I think you could also maybe distinguish between, you know, some of the films that they're making are probably not of a high quality. I think you can probably see
that. We don't make B-pictures here at Capitol.
But I mean, I think, I mean, I'd want to see that Channing Tatum musical. That looks pretty cool. But
you have
I don't
to
know,
call him
I don't
the Big Brisket.
I don't want Lonely Old Moon.
How do you like referring to Channing Tatum?
Oh, the Big Brisket.
Yeah.
He's a big, but that's Keith. That's Keith. Origin. Oh, the origin was
no,
Keith.
I can't.
And I thought, oh my God, that's perfect. And then it was one of those memes that you can't Didn't start your own it. Meme.
One of these days,
one
it's going to happen.
Days. But yeah.
Have you given up on Charming Potato?
I mean, I didn't make up Charming Potato. I can't take credit for Charming Potato.
Oh, there's no credit in Hollywood. We don't care about the writer. We don't care who originated this thing. We're just putting it up on the screen. I don't know. It amuses me that both of you have your own nicknames for Channing Tatum, and that this has been going on for like a decade now.
But we share the opinion that Josh Hutcherson is Honeycrisp.
Honeycrisp, that's right. He stands on the apple boxes because he's so short. But as far as like, again, to get back to the quality of the films in the films within the film, I think Hail Caesar itself is probably also kind of an interesting movie. You know, that not to spoil anything, but there's a speech that George Clooney delivers at the end of the film that is pretty rousing.
I agree. No, it's wonderful. It kind of ties the religious themes of the film together, and you know, to say where it goes is to spoil something, but it's a very Coen-esque. It takes a very Coen-esque.
That's
all
also in the trailer.
I know it's in the trailer.
I mean, I'm not saying that you have to give it away. I'm just saying
it's
out
too
there.
Much in the trailer of this movie.
Yeah, this is a movie that I walked out of thinking that was a fun trifle. Like that was a very entertaining Coen Brothers comedy, but a minor work. But I have thought about it so much since then, and it's because of the things that you're talking about, these themes that they do a little more than touch on, but it is not, they're not nearly as present as they are in Barton Fink. But because they're just percolating there under the surface, it really makes me want to revisit this film, and I regret that I wasn't able to see it a second time before this podcast.
Like Burn After Reading in that respect, mm-hmm, which is a movie I've enjoyed revisiting. I liked it the first time, and then I've enjoyed revisiting it since.
One of the reasons it's so revisitable is because it's so densely packed. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I said in my review for The Verge is just it feels like a TV pilot because there are so many characters that get such short shrift. Like Scarlett Johansson in particular, I wanted to see so much more of her. Yeah. And Alden Ehrenreich's cowboy Hobie Doyle, like even Tilda Swinton, like all of these characters I feel like get such short shrift, which plays into Genevieve, what's your topic?
Yeah, my topic is characters.
What a coincidence.
And actually that is a great setup for what I want to talk about specifically. So I spent a lot of time lately wrestling with the idea of what makes a Coen character, and it's been a really frustrating exercise because while it's very easy to watch a Coen Brothers film and say, yes, I'm watching a Coen Brothers character on screen right now, it's a lot more difficult to put a finger on what induces that feeling. Like, you could say that they seem to be drawn to difficult or unlikable characters like Barton Fink or Llewyn Davis, but they also have a lot of really affable characters in their stable too, like Marge Gunderson or The Dude. You could say that all their characters tend to be marked by at least one major flaw, but that is in no way unique to the Coens. That's one of the bedrocks of good storytelling, you know, the fatal flaw. Probably the most accurate, if not especially useful thing I've been able to kind of home in on is that they have a pronounced love of weirdos, you know, characters who are not necessarily the easiest to relate to. Like, I have a hard time thinking of a Coen Brothers character that I watch thinking, I know someone just like that, or that person is just like me. You know, Coen characters tend to be incredibly interesting and compelling, but not necessarily realistic. And I certainly don't mean to imply that that's a flaw. And in fact, their seeming disinterest in creating likable or relatable characters has allowed them to create some incredibly memorable ones like Barton Fink. But I think this, what I'm talking about here, might be a side effect of the fact that, in my opinion, Coen characters function as storytelling devices first and foremost. You know, most Coen characters, I talked about this a little bit in the first segment, they don't really have a complicated traumatic backstory that's driving them. Their motivations don't really extend beyond whatever happens in the story that's being told. You know, they function as narrative devices first and people second. You know, looking at Eddie Mannix, what are his primary characteristics? He's religious and he's really good at his job, both of which are traits that tie directly into the points the Coens are making with this movie. Or Baird Whitlock, we only kind of get a sense of his movie star persona. You know, he exists more as a symbol and a plot device than as a person. And Barton Fink, as I said, we don't really know anything about his backstory beyond this play that he wrote that brought him to Hollywood. And again, I don't want to imply that this is a bad thing, and I'm pretty sure we all share the opinion that most movies could do with less backstory for their characters. But I do think it speaks to the precision of the Coen styles, this idea that the characters in their films only exist to the extent that they function within the narrative of that given film. So they're ciphers, basically. Does that ring true to you guys at all, or are you going to just bombard me with exceptions to this theory?
No, I mean, I think one of the things that makes Coen Brothers movies so distinctive and so frustrating on first viewing and so exciting on first viewing and so like unpackable on later viewings is exactly what you're talking about, that sense that every character has a narrative function to serve, but an awful lot of the characters don't ever actually get to that narrative function. Mm-hmm. They really kind of excel at putting in these tiny characters who don't necessarily contribute to a larger story, but feel like they have backstories, mm-hmm. like Chet and his like weird popping out of the basement, yeah. like Scarlett Johansson's Esther Williams-esque character, who like very clearly has like, what is the background that brings this woman with this like Queens accent and this she sounds like they pulled her off the street mm-hmm. and stuck her in a bathing suit and made her an elegant superstar.
Well, thoughts about who you might marry?
I ain't doing that again. I had two marriages. It just cost the studio a lot of money to bust them up.
Well, we had to have those annulled. One was to a minor mob figure.
Vince was not minor.
And Buddy Flynn was a band leader with a long history of narcotic use.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They were both louses. Marrying a third louse ain't gonna do me no good.
I've offered you some very suitable, clean young men.
Pretty boys, saps and swishes. What, you think if there wasn't a good, reliable man, I wouldn't have grabbed him?
What about Arne Seslem? He is the father, isn't he?
Yeah.
The writer's room, full of recognizable faces, I kept waiting for each one of those people to break out, especially the photographer, played by, what, Alex Karpovsky from Girls, I believe?
Oh, yeah.
He's just like, he is all over.
I forgot he was in it. Like, and I love him.
He's all over that scene, just yeah. like leering and looming and menacing. And I don't think he has a line, and he has no purpose in the story, but he has this sense of being like part of a larger narrative of his own. And there's almost a frustration in that because of a sense of like, I want to know that guy's story now. I want to know Chet's story. Like, I want to know all of these people's stories. But that produces just such a rich and vibrant world because it feels real outside the boundaries of the world it's created.
In terms of narrative, I kind of bristled a little bit when you use the word short shrift to talk about some of these characters within the world of Hail Caesar. And it kind of struck me that one of the characteristics of this film and other Coen films is that we really often stay very close to one person. And if you look at Hail Caesar as a movie about one person and all these fires he has to put out, you're not unsatisfied by how minor roles are, even for pretty major actors. You know, I mean, you know, you don't feel like you've been shortchanged because like, their function in the narrative has been served. And this is true.
I could have done with an extra Channing Tatum scene.
That's
just
true.
I don't know. To me, the way he departs from the picture is so ridiculously so perfect.
I'm being silly. I think he's used perfectly.
It's well measured. But it's true of Llewyn Davis. It's true of you know, the Big Lebowski, even though obviously John Goodman has a bigger role there. But I mean, you do in Barton Fink, certainly. I mean, like, we don't see too much beyond their experience, or at least the events are all pertinent to the experience of one person.
You know, it's funny. I immediately want to argue with you on that because of a couple of Coen Brothers films. And then I immediately think, oh, wait, that's True Grit and No Country for Old Men, both of which come from other writers, both of which are adaptations of existing works. So no wonder they would diverge most from that formula.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a unifying theory, but the examples I'm thinking of, and certainly Hail Caesar, I don't really think about the characters other than the central characters being shortchanged, because it really is all about that one character.
I mean, Burn After Reading is kind of a big, messy sprawl with a whole lot of characters, each having their own little weird narratives going on.
The concept of that film is the star. Burn After Reading. That's what's so brilliant about it, is that it just has this very incredible. I can't believe it was a hit. It was the weirdest thing to me that film was a hit.
And what is that concept? Is that concept just, we have learned nothing?
Yeah. The concept is, let's take an enemy of the state-like spy thriller and then just make it about something that of no consequence whatsoever, where horrible things end up happening around it. I mean, it's a very impressive feat, in my opinion, to do it, to make a movie like that.
Speaking of Burn After Reading, and this is something I kind of wanted to, it applies to both your topic, Scott, and mine, so this is probably the time to throw it in, and that is George Clooney and his integration into the Coen Brothers stable, because I think you could make arguments, but I think it's safe to say he is probably the biggest movie star in the Coen Brothers company, you know? And I think it's very interesting.
Well, they've got Oscar nominee Jonah Hill now.
That's true. In one scene.
But short shrift, I tell you.
But
he meets the legal definition of personhood.
But I think it's very interesting how they use Clooney as kind of like the avatar of Hollywood in their films. And he is like their go-to schmuck. Like in every single film, he is a fool. You know, he's a kind of a vain fool. And I think he's sort of a stand-in for the idea of a movie star, the idea of Hollywood glamour. And I find that, and the fact that he seems to love that and goes along with it is wonderful.
It's a great pleasure watching him play a dumb guy.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt too in Burn After Reading.
Yeah, I feel like Brad Pitt was kind of mimicking his buddy George in that performance, as far as his willingness to play the fool for them.
I mean, it's almost like the Coens create a safe space for actors to mock themselves, mm-hmm. for them to play these really idiosyncratic, like larger than life weirdo roles. When you mention how often they just default to weirdos, I think of the line from Fargo about Steve Buscemi and like what a weird looking little guy he was.
Funny looking, you know, funny looking.
Funny looking. And
I mean Chet?
Well, I do mean Chet, because they come back to the same people over and over. And, you know, once you find somebody with the face of a John Goodman or a Steve Buscemi, like, no wonder you keep coming back to them over and over, because there is that specificity, that idiosyncrasy.
Well, they love character actors. And I think it's interesting how, as they've gotten, how they've kind of uncomfortably aligned themselves more with Hollywood, they've taken the approach of making movie stars or attempting to make movie stars into character actors. You know, I don't know that necessarily works, but it's definitely interesting, and I think speaks to their unique sensibility within the Hollywood sphere.
It's certainly probably fun for actors who have reached a point of stardom where they keep getting offered the same roles over and over. You know, George Clooney doesn't get many opportunities to play clowns anymore, mm-hmm. outside of Coen films. But that kind of covers their style in terms of writing and in terms of the performances they get. What about the rest of their style? Keith, I think you've got a topic for us.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big topic. I feel like we've covered a lot of it. Certainly the acting is a part of it as well. But I mean, I think with the Coens, with any film, you're getting a complete world. You're getting something that's been thought through from down to the tiniest detail, down to the, you know, the tiniest drips of glue
don't bring up the glue.
sorry. The tiniest bloodstained mattress to the, you know, the look of the offices here at Capitol Pictures. And part of what's so charming about Hail Caesar is to see them trying on different styles as these homages to classic Hollywood. But it's still unmistakably a Coen Brothers film in that sense. I mean, Barton Fink's an interesting one too, where it feels like their influences are more pronounced. We talked about Lynch and Eraserhead, and they cited Polanski as a strong influence on that film as well. And I think The Shining is huge. But even that, I mean, the influences are so blended. Like, I'm not going to see that as anything but a Coen Brothers film. The same with this, although you couldn't really have two films that looked or sounded much different, but they're still recognizably Coen. There's a precision to it. There's a precision to the language and the camera work and everything about it. I mean, I think if you were the Coen brothers, I think someone like Hobie Doyle, the cowboy actor who's turned into an elegant, an elegant, finely dressed leading man over the course of one day, apparently, or the attempt is made over the course of one day. I think that would be a nightmare, because anything that's going to go wrong, or any sort of like any break from the precision of what they bring to it would throw everything off. That said, neither Barton Fink nor this or any of the movies, there's not an airlessness to them that you get sometimes with the directors that have thought things through. I mean, they feel like living worlds. And I think to me, that's all that combined is what defines a Coen Brothers style, even as diverse as the films are.
Yeah, in particular, I think precision is just the perfect word for it. You know, you've got so many montages, like so many of these scenes, like tightly edited scenes that just really flow in Coen Brothers movies. And for me, that was one of the big strengths of Hail Caesar. Like, I found the whole editing scene with Frances McDormand actually a little too manic, you know, with the kind of the Looney Tunes effects and whatnot. But all of these, like the Channing Tatum dance sequence, or like I just go back to sequences in Hudsucker Proxy that are meant to kind of evoke musicals and montages in the 40s. There's just a speed and a flow and a rhythm to them that is all about like precision. That's all about control. And you mentioned Deakins as a cinematographer. He contributes so much to just these crisp, bright visual films. And as I said before, there's such a crispness to Barton Fink, even though it mostly takes place in these very dim, grotesque settings. It is amazing how saturated the colors are in a place with so little light. And I think precision just really covers their style.
Totally.
I agree. This is only like kind of tangentially related to this, but I find it interesting that both Barton Fink and Hail Caesar have scenes of characters watching dailies, which sort of more gets back to the idea of like the work involved in creating a film and like considering a film in pieces and how alien and strange that is to watch dailies. Like both Eddie Mannix and Barton Fink kind of have this experience of watching these weird little excerpted moments of film, and it highlights the artistry that goes into turning that into what we're seeing, you know, a film.
Oh, sure. I mean, it also highlights the artifice, like mm-hmm. seeing all of the failed material around what presumably is the winning shot suddenly makes it seem more miraculous that they got to that winning shot, because so much of the other material is so terrible.
Well, and if you want to get really analytical and going back to the Coens, like not really liking to talk about their films, like it kind of speaks to the futility of viewing art in pieces. You know, or just considering a single part of it as we are doing now.
But it's so much fun, though.
Yeah,
I love that scene in Barton Fink too, because he's. It's not clear if he's repulsed by the wrestling or by these burly men, or if he's just repulsed by movies. You know, you don't really get a sense that has this guy even seen a movie before?
No, he's done it. I mean, he states several times
he's
that he's
never
not
seen
really
a wrestling
into picture or just
yeah.
into pictures yeah. generally. But yeah, it's really funny that the compare and contrast there too, because you know, Mannix is his job. He sees dailies all the time. He knows what to expect, and in Barton Fink, it's like one of the most harrowing scenes in the film. Like Barton Fink is just—he's horrified by what he sees and what he's being asked to produce.
That's another just immensely Eraserhead-esque sequence where he's staring at these images that are playing out for him that he has like no involvement in and no control over. Like that's something that happens over and over throughout Eraserhead, and with just the same sort of sense of existential dread.
Just being confronted with what a movie is and how the sausage gets made. I mean, that's a whole different thing than thinking abstractly about actually writing a movie or converting his sensibility onto film. Actually making a movie is such a different thing.
Yeah, I mean, even though we kind of see the failure of movie making, like what it looks like, especially with Hobie's attempts to play a slick gentleman, we also, I think, in Hail Caesar get this very idealized view of filmmaking. Like, yeah, the studio is stepping in and being very controlling. Yeah, they're all being like they're all dealing with orders that they marching orders they don't necessarily want to follow, and mandates that they're having trouble with. But you still see that, like the dancing sequence with Channing Tatum or the swimming sequence with Scarlett Johansson, they play out in these like long, perfect takes as though they're being shot, you know, without outtakes, without pauses, without like any need for editing. It all just kind of flows smoothly in front of you, which is, I don't know, just this very dreamlike version of Hollywood. That's a kind of a dreamlike place I think they often go to with their films.
I think, though, it matters in Hail Caesar that everyone is in their proper role. I mean, that's what sort of plays out with Hobie Doyle, and that when you see him in Westerns or you see him out in the world in certain circumstances, there's just no one more at ease in the film than him. I mean, he's so charming. God, I love that character so much. Yeah. And then of course when he's
just a sucker for rope tricks.
Oh, the rope tricks. God, what a wonderful touch. And I don't know if the Coens were capable of doing that early in the career, to have a scene like the one where Hobie is waiting for this date to be arranged and he's playing with the lasso. I mean, that's just a wonderful, whimsical touch.
It's my favorite scene in the film, and not just for the, you know, joy of watching him do rope tricks, but just like the way that shot is actually composed with the city kind of stretching behind him goes back to the precision, the word we keep talking about. Like, even when there is this incredibly fun, silly thing happening in the foreground, it's still so thought out as the entire picture.
Yeah.
You know, the more I think about it and the more I kind of looking through their filmography here, the more I think that one of the reasons that stands out is because so few of their characters are comfortable in their own skin. So few of their characters are capable of relaxation, are living in a place emotionally where they're not dissatisfied either with their situations or themselves or the people around them. And there's just such an ease to that sequence that's like, you know, he's where he means to be and he's having a good time. Like, apart from Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading, maybe a few other characters, I can think of an awful lot of very unhappy Coen Brothers characters, major and minor, and not a whole lot of, like, generally relaxed ones.
Maybe you have to be a little dim to make it work.
Maybe. I don't know. I think, you know, in some ways I feel like Marge Gunderson in Fargo kind of colors my view of the whole.
She was for sure the first one who. She's like the exception to everything. I feel like everything we talk about.
Yeah, but I feel like in some ways she colors my views of the entire filmography, where it's like it's a harsh world full of cynical people, but there's also Marge Gunderson's in it. And I think in some ways that the fact that they created that character kind of puts even all the other films that she's not in kind of in a makes you see them in a different light as well.
She's also one of their only great female characters, which is something like I don't really want to get too deep into, but was kind of highlighted for me watching these two films back to back.
Well, she's, I think if you think about the Coens as having this moral universe, she's definitely mm-hmm. the sun. She's the center of that moral universe.
I mean, we don't need to get deep into it, but I do have a certain affection for Judy Davis in Barton Fink as one of their female characters who not only serves a narrative purpose, but just seems to have an inner life. An awful lot of their female characters are, as you say, they're kind of narrative impediments or narrative pushers, and they don't necessarily seem like they have much going on outside. They don't have that sense of backstory nearly as often as the really idiosyncratic male characters do. And Judy Davis plays this character in Barton Fink who's just so confident and sure of what she wants. And like, she's in a very unpleasant and ugly place where none of us would want to be. But, you know, one of the things that the Coens do, I think, is find ways for characters to be, if not comfortable in their own skin, at least comfortable in their skill sets. And she comes across as somebody who knows what her skill sets are and is good with them.
So what do you make of the fact that she needs to die in order for Barton Fink to finish his script? Like, I kind of wanted to touch on that in the first half and we didn't have room for it. But I think it's very interesting that she kind of functions as this would-be muse. And shortly after she is brutally murdered is when Barton Fink is finally able to produce a script all in one night. And it's tempting to read that as a comment on the idea of the dead woman as the instigator of action in so many films.
Sure. I mean, it's kind of a classic fridging.
Or a comment on muses in general. Yeah. Sort of a dark comment on
I think it's a very smart thing that they're doing there, but, you know, we didn't really get to unpack it
But I mean, it's also, it's just sort of the classic thing of, like, he finds something that for a moment gives him comfort in the world, and so it's got to be immediately taken away from him and in the most grotesque way possible. And it becomes kind of a classic fridging because we focus so much on his guilt and pain and what comes out of it. But I don't think that that undermines her place in the story. I don't think it undermines the richness of her character before she dies. We should start to close out. I just wanted to touch fairly briefly on my topic was just movies about movie making. It strikes me as interesting that so many films about what it's like to work in the film industry made by filmmakers, so much of them have a slightly self-pitying or slightly navel-gazing quality. And so many of them are about how crazy this industry is, how corrupt this industry is, how hard it is to make art in this industry. How do I get out of this industry? Do I want out of this industry? And I think it's interesting that Barton Fink is so dedicated to this vision of this guy who doesn't belong in the film industry, wants out, and kind of gets his last sad triumph by walking away from literally the burning wreckage of his attempt to be in the film industry. Whereas Hail Caesar, you have someone who spends the whole movie trying to decide whether he wants to walk away to what looks like a much better life and deciding in the end that, you know, this is where I want to be. This is what I want to do. I don't know if that resonates for anyone or if it just sort of seems, I mean, does it seem like the Coen brothers are happy where they are finally? Or, you know, is it just sort of the gag ending that they need to a comedy this feather light?
I mean, I think it's interesting that Hail Caesar actually engages with the idea of like movie magic, and you get to see, you know, these set pieces that we're talking about, the Channing Tatum musical sequence, Scarlett Johansson's Esther Williams pastiche. But Eddie Mannix as a character is sort of blind to this magic, like it's all happening in the background for him, but we actually get to see it. Whereas in Barton Fink, there's really none of that magic. The only actual film we see, I think, is the dailies of the wrestling picture, that I'm going to kill him or whatever, you know? So I think with Hail Caesar, they are sort of acknowledging the ephemeral magic of movies, that the effect it has on audiences. Like, I don't know about you, but I was grinning like a loon that entire musical sequence, you know, and but the fact that they include this Eddie Mannix character who's inoculated to that magic because it's just part of his daily job is maybe kind of speaks to their relationship with movie making at this point in their careers.
You know, one influence we didn't mention in terms of Barton Fink, and it's certainly one that's here too, and very explicitly references the title of one of their films is Sullivan's Travels, which is sort of deals with that question pretty directly. And looking for sincerity is kind of a fool's errand, because even if you sign off on the whole, yay, they did, it's a celebration of movie magic, it's still a fairly ugly system that produces that with
it's undercut at every turn.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a kind of a double consciousness involved in watching this and other Coen brothers films. But I think ultimately they're movie makers. They're probably ultimately come down the side of movies in one form or another in the end.
You know, I think maybe there's also a thing too about in terms of movie magic with this film, where maybe they feel compelled to remind audiences that there are people behind the scenes that are responsible for this that they don't see. You know, all these incredible things happen that are totally enchanting, but there's a lot of business that has to get done in order to make that happen. And so this is a film that kind of shines a light on that in a very affectionate way.
Well, ultimately, there's a lot of frustration, I think, both behind the scenes of any movie and in front of the scenes in any Coen brothers films. But, I mean, you can judge for yourself. Barton Fink is available on Blu-ray and DVD in many different solo and batched versions. It's on video on demand services. Hail Caesar is currently not doing immensely well in theaters, so see it while you can, because any movie that's this much about the glory of the classics really deserves to be seen on the big screen. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call this Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Scott, you want to kick us off?
Sure. You know, I decided to kind of keep this thematically appropriate or something like that and recommend another Coen Brothers film that you can watch in less than 4 minutes.
Oh, I know what this is going to be.
This is a film, it's on YouTube called World Cinema. It was made for a one of those anthology movies called To Each His Own Cinema. And it was made right around the time of No Country for Old Men. It's got the premise is very simple. It's got Josh Brolin in what pretty much is No Country for Old Men character. He's got a cowboy hat on. He goes into a movie, not a, a theater with two screens, not knowing what he's getting into at all. And the two movies are The Rules of the Game, the Jean Renoir film, The Rules of the Game, which is being listed as under its French title, Le Règle du Jeu, and Climates, the newish film by Nuri Bilge Ceylan, and he is talking to the ticket salesman about which one of those movies he should see. And I kind of just want to leave it at that, because that is the premise of the thing, and it is it's a fun movie and just a great, you know, movie lovers. Is an affirmation of the power of cinema and the power of really, I can spoil that he does choose Climates, but really somehow a film from such a faraway place can engage someone who you wouldn't necessarily think would be all that excited by it. So so I would really recommend checking it out, and it will take less than 4 minutes of your time.
Awesome. I'm going to jump in with mine then, since it will actually take less than 5 minutes of your time. In fact, I may spend more time describing it than it would take to actually watch it. You guys might be aware that, like, fairly recently there was some sort of big sports ball game that people were excited about until they watched it, and then they decided it was a boring version of that sports ball game. The Super Bowl, for some reason, gave people occasion to repost this sequence of Debbie Reynolds in a 1963 movie called I Love Melvin. You've also seen the sequence?
Yes.
It is one of the bat poop wackiest things I have ever seen.
Dressed like a football.
She is dressed like a football. She is being passed around from player to player. It kind of gives Channing Tatum's semi-homoerotic dance in Hail Caesar a run for its money in terms of waggling male butts as they play out this sort of stylized version of the big game, passing Debbie Reynolds in a skimpy football costume around from person to person, and occasionally kicking her across the field as she flies through the air. You can find it all over the internet. It's on YouTube, it's on Tumblr, it's on Facebook. It got reposted a lot. I'd never seen it before. It will blow your mind. Just search for Debbie Reynolds football. I Love Melvin.
Do you know anything about the rest of the movie? This is not a movie.
Very little. Donald O'Connor is in it. And there are other sequences from it posted here and there that are less crazy, but also kind of crazy. I keep meaning to look into like whether it's largely available and whether I can watch the whole thing somewhere. Haven't done that yet. Maybe I'll do that while other people are giving their recommendations. Keith, what are you recommending this week?
A movie I really wanted to see in the theater and yet for various reasons couldn't get to. And then, you know, some people weren't that into it. It's like, okay, I'm going to seek it out, and I'm going to watch it. And then again, life and scheduling and children and various things got in the way. But it's always a movie I was going to watch, despite some mixed receptions. And you know what? I loved Crimson Peak, and I'm somewhat baffled that others don't love Crimson Peak. It's just a beautifully stylish film of, you know, flawlessly executed stylistically. You know, we talked about the Coens immersing people into the worlds of their film. This is just sort of creates this dank, dangerous 19th century, you know, late 19th century America, and even more upsetting late 19th century England. You know, I don't want to actually, if you don't know the plot of it, I don't want to give too much away, but Mia Wasikowska is an aspiring writer and heiress, soon to be heiress to a fortune, and in the course of the film becomes the heiress to a fortune, who is romanced by Tom Hiddleston, who is an aristocrat with a great scheme to make money, but not a lot of money with which to execute that scheme. And there are ghosts, and there are schemes, and there is Jessica Chastain in a performance that is, you know, lesser hands would have been over the top, but just kind of just perfect, just perfectly, the perfect villainess. Not to give too much away, but you know she's the villain.
Oh yeah,
she's so great. In that.
And it's pays homage to everything from like Turn of the Screw to Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe movies, and I loved it. Please go, you know, seek it out now.
And I know, as you said, a lot of people did not care for that movie, but I was amazed and appalled that it did not get any recognition on the technical side by the Academy. Like, even just costumes,
set production, art design.
Del Toro is just one of the most technically you know, accomplished filmmakers, and just to the, you know, the way it's you know, the camera movement, the way it's cut together, and again the costumes and the colors, and then you know, there aren't many directors that are very much working in the CGI era, but in a way that makes them feel not CGI, kind of like...
It's visceral in the same way that Barton Fink is, I think, where you just kind of like, you get a little like, you know, crawl up your spine.
Well, part of the reason it's visceral is because they built that house.
Right.
They wanted that house. It was part of his vision that it be a real place. And that is one of those movies that even if you don't care for the movie, just dipping a toe into the behind the scenes story and like what it took to make that film mm-hmm. is so fascinating.
Well, it's such a wonderful set too. This crumbling mansion, like just the idea of a house that is incapable of actually sheltering the outside element, sheltering people from the outside elements, and the snow pouring down through. Anyway,
my favorite reaction to the film, this was on Twitter by a friend of ours named Sarah. She was, I guess, mocking, having sort of a mock conversation, was like, the line readings are stiff, and she's like, who gives a bleep? The snow is bleeding. Which is like, absolutely correct.
My favorite reaction to that film was my reaction. I wrote a piece for IO9 about how that film like
that
typifies like everything that Guillermo del Toro does. And the only reason I feel like I can get away with recommending myself on this one is Crimson Peak made it clear to me how to interpret all his films in a way that none of his films, like it was the piece that
Tell
popped
me.
Into place for me.
In short,
the elevator pitch is all of his films are fundamentally about reconciling yourself with the past and learning to let it go. And they address it in very different ways. And I get into a lot of detail in the piece. You can find it on IO9. But fundamentally, the reason he loves ghost stories so much, the reason he makes so many of them, the reason he produces so many of them, and the reason he comes back to ghost-related themes is because a ghost is a piece of the past that will not dissipate, that's stuck in time and has to be exercised, has to be let go in some way. There's a lot more to it, but that's the nut of it.
It sounds convincing.
It is convincing. You know what else is convincing? I Love Melvin is available on DVD. It's a musical apparently about a struggling actress, and the football sequence is her appearing in a kitschy Broadway show. So it's a story inside a story. You can find it on DVD via Amazon.com and other services. Genevieve, would you like to recommend something to us?
Yes, I brought a film-related item, and I brought it with me. I'm going to hold it up and see if Keith knows
it fits right into the stuff we've been talking about.
Yes, this was just kind of a perfect cross-section of the two movies that we're discussing here. I am holding up a comic book in three parts, or three acts in this case. It's called The Fade Out. It's written by Ed Brubaker, who is probably most well-known for writing Captain America for a really long time, including the arc that would become the Winter Soldier film. And it's set in the exact era we're talking about, the studio system era of Hollywood. Like I said, it's a perfect cross-section of Barton Fink and Hail Caesar in that it's a crime story, it's a noir, but it's also like a deep dive into this very specific era of Hollywood and the studio system. The main character is a frustrated writer. The Hollywood blacklist factors into the story, and it really gets into what it means to be a pawn, more or less, in this system. And Tasha, this is for you. It passes the Bechdel test, even though the story is kicked off by a murdered woman. It has a kind of an amazing female character at the center of the story. And, you know, when I started reading the book, I was like, oh, it's about a tortured, drunk white male writer. But the two central female characters are very interesting. And I think the story does right by them, while also being this really dark and traumatic story that happens to revolve around a dead woman.
One's playing a female Eddie Mannix in a way. Too.
Definitely. It's a really compelling read with gorgeous, gorgeous artwork by Sean Phillips and colors by Elizabeth Breitweiser. And it has just a lot of really direct, specific references to this period in Hollywood. Clark Gable factors in briefly. If you've recently done this double feature that we've covered today and aren't, you know, quite ready to leave this world yet, I'd highly recommend this book. It's The Fade Out, and it's available in collected trade paperback in three parts.
And it's currently available in Genevieve's lap.
Yes, I brought it in case anyone would like to borrow
presume, that you brought it so I could jerk it out of your hands right now and run off with it. All right. Well, that means we're going to wrap up this podcast so I can go get reading. Before closing the book on this week's episode, we should reveal the movie pairing for our next episode, which comes out March 1st and 3rd. Most of us have already seen The Witch, the debut film of set and production designer Robert Eggers, which takes an extremely well-researched, emotionally intense look at a family on a 17th century farm that may or may not be troubled by actual witches. It's hard to communicate exactly how excited we are about this deeply idiosyncratic personal film and how different it is from anything we've seen in a long time. Specifically, it's different from anything we've seen since 1973, when Robin Hardy's The Wicker Man took Edward Woodward on a terrifying journey into a similarly isolated community that's having pagan troubles. We'll be looking at The Witch and Hardy's original version of The Wicker Man in 2 weeks, which gives you a little time to get caught up on my interview with Robert Eggers at The Verge and Scott's interview with him at Rolling Stone. Either one of those interviews should give you an idea of why we all love this film. Except for Genevieve, who hasn't seen it yet because she's scared. The Wicker Man is actually one of my all-time favorite films, so just make sure you don't actually watch the Nicolas Cage remake and show up in 2 weeks hoping we'll answer the question, how to get burned, how to get burned, how to get burned! In the meantime, we would love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Barton Fink, Hail Caesar, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before we close out this episode, where can we find everyone these days? Scott.
Well, you can find me at NPR, Variety, Vulture, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, UpRocks, and Oscilloscope's Musings. What about you, Keith Phipps?
Wait, are you on social media such as Peach?
Yeah, I'm sorry. yes.
We all really need to hear about your membership.
You can also find me on Twitter at Scott Tobias and on Peach at Scott Tobias as well. I'll be doing a little doodles and playing Peach Ball. So Peach Ball is a new thing.
Peach still exists.
I love it.
Still, yeah, all these weeks later?
All the time. Keith, what about you?
I'm at UpRocks behind the scenes and a little bit in front of the scenes. And on social media, Twitter at KPhipps3000 and then also on Peach at KPhipps3000. I think my Peach app may have deleted itself. But
what about all your Batman sketches?
Lost like tears in the rain.
Genevieve, who are you on Peach?
I enjoy peaches, if that helps. They are my favorite fruit. But I am on Twitter. You can find me at Genevieve Kosky, and I recently wrote about the Coen brothers at GQ. You can seek that out.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson and writing film reviews and general entertainment articles at The Verge. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at NextPicturePod or by visiting NextPictureShow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks again to Genevieve Kosky for producing the show.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Genevieve Kosky for sitting in that editing room surrounded by clacking machines and occasionally getting dragged in almost to her death. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. And finally, we'd like to thank our parent podcast, Film Spotting, for all their help, input, and support. Please tune in next time and keep this in mind. It's much too dangerous to jump through the fire with your clothes on. Please practice safe paganism while watching The Wicker Man.
We'll be searching high and low on the deck and down below, but it's a crying shame. Oh, we'll see a lot of fish, but we'll never clock a dish. We ain't gonna see a dame.